Welcome to the Grow Bold with Disability podcast, brought to you by Feros Care, a podcast dedicated to smashing stereotypes and talking about the things people with disability care about most to help us live bolder, healthier, better connected lives. I'm journalist Pete Timms.
And I'm Tristram Peters. I work for Disability Service Directory Clickability and I'm a wheelchair user living with spinal muscular atrophy.
Today's episode of Grow Bold with Disability is Growing Bold and Carers. And our guests today are Ellie Mae Barnes, an amazing singer and mother of a wonderful young son, Dylan, who lives with cerebral palsy. And her father, who some of you may have heard of, maybe not, I guess the majority would have, Aussie rock legend Jimmy Barnes. Now in this episode, we'll discover how Ellie Mae got cerebral palsy, how it affected the Barnes family, and how she's grown into an amazing singer and a mum. Ellie Mae and Jimmy, welcome to Grow Bold with Disability.
Hey, how are you guys?
Fantastic.
Really well.
Should have done that in harmony. We should have done that in harmony, shouldn't we?
Hello. Well, I'm not a good singer, so we'll have to work on that on my part. But anyway.
We're auto-tuned, no problem.
I love it. So, Ellie Mae, let's start with you. Do you mind explaining to us what is cerebral palsy?
So, it's basically, it's a physical disability. So, mine affects mainly my right side, but also my left leg, and involves spasms and like the brain signal kind of gets mixed up. So what my brain wants me to do does not translate to most of my limbs, which is always fun.
That's something new every day.
Yeah.
But I think it happened in Ellie Mae was born very premature. She was born at 20 weeks, so 14 weeks premature. And had some sort of brain bleed
on the left side,
which affected the whole right side. And so now both sides spasm because Ellie Mae's been compensating with her left side so much because the right side wasn't getting the signals that both sides spasm. And consequently, she's lived with chronic pain for most of her life for a little thing.
So, Jimmy, you said she was prematurely born. I think it was 4 weeks premature.
14,
sorry. What was the diagnosis from the doctors at that time? What did they tell you?
No, it was nothing. We really didn't know a lot about at the time. It was work day to day, just trying to keep Ellie alive. I mean, literally, she weighed 750 grams. She was just a bather in a kidney dish. She was that small, and it was 32 years ago. And obviously technology has changed a lot in the last, 32 years. But back then, it was purely through the skill and the will of the doctors and the nurses at the Westmead neonatal intensive care that kept her alive. And in that process, the babies are intubated and they're getting oxygen and all this sort of stuff. And that's always a fine balance of getting the right amount of oxygen to the blood and all that sort of stuff, not too much. So we don't know exactly when or where, but in that process, sometime Ellie Mae had a brain bleed. And we didn't really know for sure.
I think with cerebral palsy, you can't normally diagnose it until you don't start hitting certain milestones as far as movement goes, and crawling. And then obviously walking is not my strong point either. So I think when I hit probably around 2 or 3,
it became more apparent.
I moved differently. Yeah.
And then it was just a matter of they went and did more tests to see how much what limitations Ellie would have with her movement and what it had actually affected. And that became more apparent as she got older. And our job really as parents was just to try to take as much pressure off Ellie so that she, as she grew up, we didn't treat Ellie Mae any differently than the rest of the family. And she was just the one that couldn't run and all that sort of stuff. But she was just, we just made it as easy and as normal as possible for her. So it didn't really affect her much until she got older, really.
So what sort of adjustments did you make around the home? Was there anything in particular that was just a little bit different?
Well, I mean, growing up, I could get around fairly easily. Like the spasms would have, you know, gaps in them at which point I could walk, and mostly, and I've always kind of leant on things with my hands. I haven't particularly used a walking stick or anything.
She's always been a bit clumsy, but she was getting, she just got around. In our house, we had the odd stair here and there, and she just ran around. She was just a bit clumsy.
I fell downstairs a few times.
She's a bit clumsy.
Yeah. It never really bothered me, things being slightly more difficult. I was just sort of like happy to be.
But there was all the way through her life, though, there were these periods where she'd have 3 months set of casts on one leg or both legs. So then she would be sort of hobbling around. She was incredibly one of those kids who was just incredibly happy all the time and didn't let on that anything was wrong. And I think even in the early days, because we normalized things so much, Ellie didn't really know that things were that wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They didn't, and she went to school as normal. She didn't, she couldn't, sports day wasn't a big day for Ellie.
Well, I was seriously in year two, but I believe I came last, but I had two casts on and I mysteriously got a running trophy. at the sports day, and we went out to celebrate it for lunch.
Yeah.
Catalina, and we celebrated. But I didn't find out till I was in my teen, because I was always like, that's kind of weird. Like, nobody else got a trophy. And I lost. So then I found out when I was like 15 that Dad had given it to my teacher to give to me.
We used to do that with all the kids because we know they weren't particularly good at sport. Anyway.
So I've had delusions of grandeur for a very long time.
No, for about a week, she had, she thought she was going to become a sprinter.
Now, you did mention pain. Tell us about that, because you have had a lot of issues with your pain, haven't you?
Yeah. So it just seems to sort of, as I'm getting older, the way that I move is obviously mechanically messing with how my bones sit and all of that kind of stuff. And so there's a lot of nerve pain and some damage from previous operations. Like, we had matching back pain.
Yeah. I got mine from 65 years of being a larrikin,
Yeah. I barely moved at all. Like,
I deserve mine. I really did.
So it's just like, I feel like I've got a lot of older problems.
But Ellie's legs turn in and that affected her hips, which affect her back and affects the whole way up
your
spine.
It's the whole body. Yeah. And then, like, I have one remaining limb, the poor thing. And well, it's they're all here. It's just this one listens to me. So this whole side has taken on so much. I've had a lot of injuries along the way, but I'm basically in a constant state of pain. And I have different kinds of pain from spasm, pain from arthritis, pain from like the way that I'm sitting or standing or walking or staring.
Because Ellie May's muscles, for instance, even the first pain, the spasming, because the muscles would spasm all the time, one of the doctors at the Westmead at the rehab center said, it was, imagine if you ran a marathon every day. Your muscles, it's letting out that much lactic acid. It's just agony from that alone, just
and
muscular
so
pain.
So much inflammation. Like
and then that affected everything else. Yeah.
So it's all try balancing act. Not really, I can't balance. But there's always things you have to do to intervene. Like, I don't like strong painkillers. I had to take them a lot through my teens, and mental health-wise, that's probably what affected me more than the condition itself, because I'm okay with being a bit different or having to do things a little differently. Although it has, as I've gotten older, it's gotten harder because obviously, so it's, it's wear and tear on the body. But I don't know. It's kind of.
Yeah, but Ellie was incredible as a child, even though she did have, different surgeries and things to extend the tendons and extend the muscles. So there were some serious surgeries, and Ellie was like this trooper who just, and so even then, her brothers and sisters, they didn't treat her any different because she just acted like nothing was wrong and just kept, she was like a real trooper. And it got to the point where, we'd be doing compensating for Ellie, and the other kids are going, she's fine. What are you talking about? And they'd sort of forgotten that she had cerebral palsy, whereas, she was struggling with it for most of her, all of her life. And as she's got older, those conditions are getting harder to deal with, and they compound and become more, It is a juggling act, really, to sort of to keep things, you know, you fix one thing and something else plays up. You work on this thing. And so at the moment, we're trying some quite radical stuff. You know, Ellie's had both tendons extended, both calf muscles extended, trying to open up so it can open up the hips and stop the back and maybe give us some more better balance and be able to walk, you know,
for
a bit
longer,
of extension,
like, yeah,
extension
long
on
term.
It. Yeah. And so
how's that going?
Well, I don't think I have this thing with doctors sometimes where I'll hear one thing and if it sounds a bit scary, I'll kind of be like, okay, that's what I'm thinking about, and I tune out for the rest of it. So I didn't quite realize the recovery time.
Ellie May had this surgery, and the day after she said, come and pick me up, we're all good. The doctor said I can leave.
I
said, really? Yeah. This is major surgery. She said, no. So we brought her home and Ellie couldn't move at all. She's in the wheelchair and she couldn't even get, you know, into the wheelchair or out of the wheelchair. It was impossible. And we're saying, are you sure, the doctor said? And then we looked at the list of painkillers she was on, and it was enough to sort of stop a small herd of elephants. And I'm going, really, Ellie, I don't know if you should be at a hospital. And she said, yeah. No, the doctor told me I could. So, but we rang the hospital and the doctor said that they wanted her in for 3 months. The day after, and so we drove her back up to Sydney, and she went back in the hospital about a month and a half.
5 weeks.
5 weeks. Yeah.
Oh no, 6 weeks. Yeah.
A month and a half. Where I come from.
2 weeks at the.
Okay, a month and a half, and the problem is though.
And I got kicked out though.
But the problem is after a month and a half, you know, they're saying they started doing some physio and stuff like that. But then the thing that they're fixing where she's supposed to be doing the physio to stretch the calves and stuff like that was fine, but the tendons on the ankle were giving. So she couldn't. So now she's back in the wheelchair and she can't do the physio. And so this is a sort of a much.
Stubborn though, because they tell you things like what you can tolerate, and now I can actually tolerate like a lot, but apparently what my body can tolerate is very different to what I can, because my coping mechanism, like Dad said, I've always been just happy and like nothing's the matter.
I'm just going to get out of the wheelchair and pick up this you know, kid's toy from the floor here, and boom, there's a tendon again, you know, so it sets her back 3 months.
Or like, yeah, I can show myself at the hospital, and then they're like, okay, well, where
slipped over, and you know, so she's been having a lot of problems. It's for this operation, which probably she thought was going to take a day to recover, and then we thought might take 3 months. It's probably going to take more than 12 months to recover.
Oh, yeah.
Wow. The reality of it. And then there'll be the physio of relearning how to walk properly and balance and strengthening muscles to go with that afterwards.
So they now have no muscles.
It's quite a daunting prognosis, but we just going to play it day by day, really.
Yeah. How do you deal with that frustration, Ellie Mara? Is it just business as usual? It's just normal life?
I'm sort of used to random setbacks. Huge. This is bigger than anything I've done before. But I should have remembered that my body really doesn't recover well from anything. So now I'm in, like, I was lucky enough to find a good chair that's a bit more narrow than the one I was trying to get around in.
It's lighter.
At the hospital, it's lighter. It can.
We've got a really good mobility a vehicle. It's called a LEM. It's called. It's a mobility scooter which you can drive around, just around between our houses.
It looks like a ridiculous tiny car.
Yeah, it's like a little car. So we're just trying to keep her off her feet and not trying not to extend anything until. But the big issue is how it affects her mentally and emotionally. I think because it's like I said, Ellie's always been the one who charged ahead. And, you know, she came out and she's done two shows since she left hospital.
The first one was a week out of hospital.
A week?
And it was 2.5 hours long.
And we said, I'm going, you can't do it. And she wouldn't cancel it. So I said, well, you have to sit down the whole time. You have to be there. And, of course, she stood up for the whole show. And then I set her back another 3 months. Yeah.
And then I did the day surgery and then I did one 3 days after
I
popped out of a giant cape.
Yeah, and I'm saying, just make it nice and easy. And I go to the show, and Ellie Mays, the first thing is she jumps out of a cape. And I'm going, oh, Ellie.
But I think the balance, I need that for my mental health as well.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah, absolutely.
Jimmy, what sort of support did you guys get from outside, from when Ellie Mae was young to all the way up through now?
Listen, we found the support was incredible when Ellie was under 18,
yep.
particularly from the rehab center at Westmead. Incredible doctors, incredible follow-up, incredible teams. But we to tell you the truth, Ellie can elaborate on this, but we've seemed to, since she became an adult, you sort of get put out there and you're on your own. And you have to sort of start putting your own team together. And that's been really difficult.
We're still dealing with that
12 years later, you know, trying to deal with, you know, getting the pain management and the surgeon and the physio and the person who does the Botox to all communicate. They're not in the same building. They're not in the same team. There's no one overseeing the whole thing. So that's sort of been a difficult thing.
Yeah, and no one specializes in just cerebral palsy. So there's an orthopedic surgeon and they deal with feet and ankles, but they might not deal with much spasticity. So me not recovering the same way.
Mm.
Quite often surgeons don't want to do surgery. It's funny that, you know. Yeah.
That's how they know how to
That's how they fix things. Whereas, you know, then the physio go, really, last thing you should have done is that surgery. They go, why didn't you tell me this before?
Wow.
So it sort of seems to me that there should be someone like a management team of all these functions so that they can all talk together and communicate and get the best. Because otherwise Ellie, because we, you know, it's not, you know, this is Ellie's life and we're here to help and to help make things easier for her. But Ellie chooses to do and research and find out what she wants to do. But if she gets the wrong information, then, you know, it's hard to, and we'll go, why did you do that? And she said, that's what the specialist said. And then the next specialist who visits a week later said, oh, God, you shouldn't have done that.
Mm.
But also I was at the point before these operations where my tendons could, like, tear and fully detach, which has been a great fear of mine. And, I mean, this I've seen, whilst the recovery is extreme, I've already seen some benefits as far as stuff I couldn't do before. Like I can straighten my leg, which couldn't happen because everything was.
But it is going to be a more long-term thing than what you expect.
I definitely, it's like more of a year than a day.
I think a year is closer than a day.
Misinterpreted that, but then again, I've always been,
That's Ellie's drag name, misinterpreted.
Now, Ellie, obviously music's been a big part of your life ever since you were young. Has that helped you as you're growing up with mentally as well as just the physical fun part of singing?
I'd say singing and dress ups and things like that have always been an escape and a, having that passion or having something to plan and look forward to is a huge part of what's gotten me through all the harder parts of having cerebral palsy. But, I try and never miss a gig. I was trying to go on tour.
Yeah.
Ellie's
been singing with my band for years.
Mm.
And it's got over the last few shows of what we were doing before Ellie had the surgery, she was literally getting, you know, we'd get on stage and halfway through the show, she'd be in tears and carried off the stage, you know, because it was so much pain. So we all knew something had to change. Either she didn't do the shows, which was, you know, we want her to do, and she really wants to do it. She's a great singer. Or she had to find, that's why this led her to this surgery, this treatment. But I think the music, you know, as much as I complain about her, you know, running out and doing a 2-hour show, the music is her way of emotionally expressing pain and fear. And, you know, the cabaret show that Ellie did in the last few shows, the theme for the shows was walking. You know, she did Walk Like an Egyptian. You know, walk right in, walk on by, you know, walk like a man. That, you know, and she's doing all these songs and she, you know, Walking After Midnight. And she's going, I love singing songs about walking because I can't walk. and it was her way of sort of like, you know, and people were laughing and I'm sitting and it's tearing my heart out watching it. But I knew that that's what the whole thing was. It was Ellie making fun of the thing that was most painful to her. And the way she's always done, so I think music is like music therapy as well. As much as it's great expression, and she's really good at what she does, it's also really good therapy for her.
Yeah, definitely.
I was just going to ask Jimmy, the entertainment industry. Let's just talk about that for a second, and their attitudes towards people with disabilities. Have you seen changes over the years? Accessibility to venues, all that sort of stuff. Has that changed a lot?
Not really. I mean, you'd be surprised. I mean, we've got like friends of Ellie's have come to shows, and there's not great wheelchair access to a lot of shows, to a lot of theatres, certainly not backstage. You know, you get lifted up and carried up fire escape stairs into shitty dressing rooms with narrow doors. And so it's not from an attitude of the entertainers, but it's just the infrastructure is not there to support it. And you know, we've talked about this for 20 years. You know, I remember doing 35 years ago doing shows with Jeff St. John. And seeing Jeff keep doing RSL clubs and sports clubs, getting carried in his wheelchair up four flights of stairs by two of the roadies half dropping him and all this sort of stuff, just so he can get on stage and tear the audience apart.
Mm.
The audience had no idea how much effort it took for Jeff to get up there, let alone to perform doing his show, doing wheel stands and singing Teach Me How to Fly, you know?
Yeah.
It was, and people are like, oh, he's really good. They don't realize what he went through to get there.
And the travel.
Yeah. Just, you know, how to get in the car, how to get out of a car, the bathrooms, So I think people are, what's the right word? You know, it's like, you know, they know they should be, you know, we all care about people with disabilities, but nobody's actually doing anything about it. Mm. I think that's the truth.
Even new theaters
are built still, you know, they might have one ramp somewhere, but they don't have accessibility. And it's always difficult to get from the dressing room to the stage or from the, if you're in the front of house watching a band, we'll just have two tiers down without a ramp. You've got a ramp up in the thing, and then you can't go anywhere once you get in there. You can't get to the bathrooms. You can't get to the stage. You can't, you know, can't move around the hall freely. So I think as much as we all like to think that we're all you know, on board with caring and equality for disabilities, I think it's sort of pushed to the wayside when it comes down to budget.
Yeah.
Sure.
I hate to be cruel and callous about it, but I think that's what it is. When they're building, they go, no, we don't have to worry about that now. Let's just build. And save money. It really breaks my heart.
Yeah. How do we change that? How do we make access a reality?
I think it's like every other. It's a human rights issue. Like every other civil human rights issue, it takes a fight, and we all have to fight for it. I mean, we're all talking about equality and women's rights and all that. It's about equality. Full stop. It's not about women's rights or black lives or disability. It's about everybody being thinking and caring and being decent human beings and thinking about each other and how to make that. And you know, and when it comes down to the big business building things or infrastructure or whatever, it has to be legislated to say this has to be built like this. There's no way around it. If you're going to be able to build a building, you've got to have proper wheelchair access in the back doors, in the front doors, in the fire exits, in the bathrooms, in the venue, everywhere. It's not, yeah. So you legislate that. And then the attitudes themselves, that comes from just everybody standing up and saying, hey, we expect to be treated and to treat people the way we like to be treated ourselves.
Yeah, beautiful. Actually, Ellie, just on the people's attitudes and so forth. Now, you've got a wonderful son, Dylan, who's six. Is he six? Yeah. Not seven yet, is he? Seven's not yet. Now, was there anyone that said to you, you couldn't, or you shouldn't have children having cerebral palsy? Did you ever come up against that?
Not exactly those words, perhaps, but it was implied that it would take a huge toll on my body. It was treated as a high-risk pregnancy from the start. Like, physically, I reacted a lot, like, and all the weight gain as well, more pressure on the parts of my body that were already struggling under pressure, under stress. But, you know, there were people that said I wouldn't really recover from the pregnancy, and they weren't entirely incorrect, but my baby was fine, he was healthy, but I was always scared that my body would be too stressful an environment to kind of house him.
He's fantastic, he's strong.
He was 3.5 kilos and like, yeah. He's one of the healthiest little boys I know. But I was always worried during the pregnancy, but then I tried not to like stress and, you know, because I didn't want to pass that on, my fears onto my baby. But he's now grown into this beautiful, like, compassionate young man because of he's really aware, because it's a different stage of my life where I am struggling a bit more physically, and he is always wanting to help. He's always, you know,
he's a caring human
being. He's caring. The principal says he's the kid who always helps anyone who's fallen over or does anything that's upset. He's always very caring. He wants to help people. So.
And now, but it's funny that that it makes me think about, you know, there's a lot of people who have opinions about what how to manage and how to make things better. You know, you can talk about meditation, physio, yoga. You can talk about, you know, all the things that you can do. And if you put them all in, and the problem is when Ellie does all those things, she's much better.
Yeah.
Much better. Her mobility, everything. When she can do them, if she can't do one, sort of maybe sometimes four or five of them will disappear. You know, they talk about pain management. Much, much rather be having, you know, cannabinoids than bloody.
Than CBDs and things, yeah.
CBDs and stuff, you know, and they didn't make that easy for people to get, you know, and it really does help, you know, mentally and physically with the pain.
Oh, like insanely.
Yeah, and it's only the last, you know, what 2 years you've been getting.
Not even that.
But before, like, that was really difficult for her to get access to any of that sort of stuff.
And the opiates, like, nearly killed.
Opiates were like making her suicidal, you know. It was just terrible.
Yeah, and also I was like so skinny because I just put like and my tolerance kept creeping up, and so by the time I stopped taking opiates and stuff, I was on like 2 OxyContin a day and on like just morphine patches, and I just like was barely surviving. And I see photos, I used to have to end up getting drips, my kidneys struggle. Like I was just, and I didn't realize it at the time because I was just still being, you know, silly about it and whatever. But it was like I could have died then very easily. Definitely. And I was taking what I was told to take.
Yeah, I never told them to take more. And we're going, we're sitting back, we're going, you're taking so many, you've forgotten you've taken them. So it's a dangerous situation. And as an adult, you know, Ellie, you know, she lives in her own home. We can't be there to say, oh, no, you've taken that one, you know. And so it was a worry for us. But in saying that, once Ellie, if we get on top of this in the next 12 months, like, for instance, to get her back to a starting point, I think Ellie is going to have to use the CBD, the yoga, the meditation.
Yeah,
it's meditation and medication. You're going to have to do all the holistic, combine it all. Because when that happens, you know, when you do aquatherapy, it's all really good.
And
all the things
therapy,
everybody says, and mental therapy. We all have, you know, everybody in this family has to do that. You know, we all need that. Right? I think every human needs to do that, actually.
Yes. Yeah. 100%.
So as we know, our podcast is called Grow Bold with Disability, and we always like to ask our guests, what does growing bold mean to you?
You know what? I think Ellie Mae's always been bold. You know, she's always not been afraid to have a go and just step forward, you know, sometimes wobble forward, but always, you know, charged into things and willing to make the effort and be positive. And I think being positive and being prepared to change, being prepared to have setbacks, being prepared to have, you know, to make giant leaps forward as well. But to do that, you have to be prepared to take that chance first. And that's what Ellie's, and being bold as a parent for me is, I've learned that from watching Ellie Mae.
Beautiful. And Ellie Mae, what's it mean for you growing bold?
Man, how do I follow that guy?
Like, for me, was I any good?
I come from a family of bold people.
Bold, yeah, you know, you've got bold pitch, yeah.
I don't know, growing bold, it is. It's being radically accepting of who you are and your limitations, and yet being open to trying anything. And, you know, also like being able, I think being bold is also being able to laugh and to
not being told what you can.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I've stood up my first try surfing, albeit on a giant board, but, you know,
that was only 2 years ago.
I can barely stand on solid ground.
She stood on a surfboard,
so I mean, I think it's being open to trying things, being open to pushing against the boundaries, because nowhere in the world is built to be physically the way that I am, and I'm just going to keep trying to fight that and, you know, and try and just be who I am and not be ashamed or anything like that. Just, I don't know.
Fantastic. Beautiful. I love it. Absolutely love it. Well, Ellie Mae and Jimmy, thank you so much for joining us today here on Grow Bold with Disability, podcast brought to you by Pharos Care. And our listeners can find out more about Ellie Mae and Jimmy in our links provided in today's show notes. Guys, thank you so much for that today. That was such a wonderful chat.
No problem.
Thank you.
This podcast is brought to you by Pharos Care, an NDIS partner delivering local area coordination services in Queensland, South Australia, and the Australian Capital Territory. Pharos Care is a people care organisation committed to helping people live bolder lives. We call it Growing Bold. And for over 30 years, Pharos has been making it real for both older Australians and those living with disability. To find out more, head to pharoscare.com.au.